Lord, you have every reason why you could be and should be a bitter God when we think about the fact that we were your enemies, that we despised you, that we rejected you, and that even now that we know you, we still turn our eyes toward other gods and are quick to run toward things that will not satisfy, bread that will not fulfill, broken cisterns. Lord, thank you that you are not a bitter God, and thank you that as your children, we have the opportunity to become more and more like you, which means we are not going to be bitter people, but also means, Lord, that we get to emulate you in how to live with people who are bitter. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to look like you, to be able to show the kindness and love that you've shown to us, to others. Lord, I pray that we would just be eager to do that, that we would pant after that, not because it's such a pleasant thing to do, but because we love and adore you so thoroughly that the opportunity to get to reflect you in our lives would be very, very precious to us. Would you please meet with us now and just help us to learn everything that we can about this subject so that we will be better equipped to represent you as faithfully as possible. Thank you, Lord. We love you. Amen. All right, we are going to use as our case study this morning the book of Ruth. And we're going to go through quite a bit of it. So if you want to be turning there, I'll be reading from the NIV 1984, but they're going to be pretty close. But before we get there, let me just ask you to think of a person in your life who bugs you. Now, I don't need you to shout it out, but just get it in your mind, a person in your life who bugs you. And think about it, why is it that they bug you? Okay, maybe it's your brother who always picks on your weakest areas and brings it to everyone's attention with his merciless teasing. I see you colored your hair again. Did you think that would keep people from knowing that you were turning 40? Okay, maybe it's your brother. Maybe it's not your brother. Maybe it's your niece who just treats her parents like dirt. And you've seen how loving her parents are toward her, and it just gets under your skin that she is so disrespectful to them. Maybe it's not your niece. Maybe it's your mother-in-law, who everybody else thinks is just wonderful. But when you try to get close to her, she's cold, she's rejecting. She is convinced that you are not good enough for her child. Well, nevertheless, you're stuck with that person, right? If it's a relative, if you've ever watched the movie A Christmas Story, if you're like many people, one of the parts that you may remember most is when Ralphie was triple dog dared to lick the frozen flagpole. I see some of you remember that, okay? Well, he was triple dog dared, so of course he had to do it, and so he gets his tongue out there and licks it, and what happens as soon as he licks it? He's stuck, right? He is stuck to that frozen flagpole, and the kids all gather around him, and then the recess bell rings, and the kids are leaving to go back in, and Ralphie's there going, hey, don't leave me, don't leave me. But he's stuck. He is stuck. And sometimes that's how it is with difficult relatives, right? You are stuck with them. Christmas, weddings, funerals, they're going to be there. And sometimes it means you're stuck living with a bitter person. Now, as we read the book of Ruth, I think we see an example of a difficult relative. And interestingly, the relationship here in the book of Ruth is mother-in-law, daughter-in-law. And how far would we have to go in our circle of acquaintances today to find a difficult mother-in-law, daughter-in-law relationship? I think God's word is always relevant. He just gives us a beautiful case study here. So let's set the stage for how to live with a bitter person by just reviewing a large portion of the book of Ruth. And I wouldn't normally do this, but I'm going to read just a large portion of this book. I think it's going to help us to just get it fresh in our minds as we go through this. So, chapter 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephratites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah, the other named Ruth. After they'd lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. Okay, so we now have the stage set. We have the major players in this book. We've got Naomi and her two daughters-in-law, and each of them has lost a husband. So, what are they going to do? How are they going to respond? Well, first thing we see here is Naomi decides she's going to leave. Verse 6, when she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. So, now they have packed up all their stuff. They are heading back to Judah. Now, how many of you have moved, say, in the last 3 years? I would have guessed that a lot of people would have done that. We are a very mobile society. Tell me, when you get ready to move, what all do you have to do? It's a lot of work, isn't it? You've got to, first of all, fix up the house, right? In fact, you've got to paint it. You've got to do all the repairs that you never did while you were living there. This house has got to be in better shape than the entire time you've lived there, right? So you've got to get all that done, okay? Then you've got to look for boxes, right? So you've got to hang around the grocery store dumpsters or something like that. You got to go to the post office, put in the address change things. You've got to disconnect all the utilities, get the bills stopped, all that kind of stuff. Okay, you've got to do that. Then you've got to say goodbye to all your friends. Okay, you've got all that to do. You've got to get everything packed up, and your moving day gets here. The U-Haul is there. You are straining your back to get that box of books on there that you should not have packed in such a big box. You knew better. You did it anyway. Then you're looking over and you're seeing the teenage boy from across the street picking up your box of china. You're wincing, thinking that may never make it to our new location. You get that all done. Your U-Haul is packed to the brim. You cram your sweaty bodies into the cab of it. You start off down the road to your new destination. You get 70 miles down the road, and your mother-in-law says to you, go back. Go back. Well, I'll just tell you from my wicked heart, if my mother-in-law said that to me, that would probably be the end of any good mother-in-law, daughter-in-law relationship right there, okay? Really? You're serious? You let me pack up everything. You let me sell the house. You let me disconnect all the utilities, and you want me to go back? Verse 8. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Then she kissed them and they wept aloud. I'd be weeping too, but I'm not sure for the same reason they were. Then she kissed them and they wept aloud and said to him and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband. And even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. Now, we're going to see in just a little bit that Naomi is going to call herself a bitter person, but I think maybe we begin to see just a little taste of it right here. A little bit of sarcasm coming through there. Are you going to wait for me to have sons and wait for them to grow up so you can marry them? Okay. And that's one of the characteristics of a bitter person is you become so immersed in your own troubles and your own suffering that you no longer see the suffering of others. Who all has lost a husband in this story?
All of them.
All of them have lost a husband, and yet Naomi is so immersed in her own suffering that she's not able to see that and minister to her daughter-in-laws anymore. At this they wept. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Now, I am about ready to read the worst verse in this whole book, I believe. It's horrid. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and what? And her gods. Go back with her. Naomi is an Israelite. She knows the one true and living God, the only God. And she says to her, and I mean, it's in here in black and white for us. We don't have to just kind of read into the text and think, well, she's telling him to go back. Didn't she understand what she was telling him to go back for? No, she said it. She said it. She said, go back to your people and your God. To what? To gods? To false gods that can't save? What is she essentially saying to her daughter-in-law? If her daughter-in-law does go back to her gods, what's going to happen to her in eternity? Essentially, she is saying in so many words, go to hell. Go to hell. I'm infuriated by that. Every time I read that, when I think about somebody who has the one true and living God saying to somebody else, don't come with me, go back to your gods. But bitterness will do that to us. Bitterness will do that to us. It's horrid. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Now, this is the first time we hear Ruth say anything. And it's amazing, isn't it? She's just, in so many words, been told, go to hell, and she responds with kindness. With kindness. Now, we know that what we say comes from our heart. So what had to be composing Ruth's heart was kindness. Because that's not something that you just pull out of thin air when somebody makes a comment like that to you. Ruth responds in kindness. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women explained, can this be Naomi? Well, she's been gone for a long time. This is her hometown. She's come back. Is this Naomi? Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. And what is Ruth? Bitter. Chopped liver, right? I went away full. Here is my daughter-in-law right next to me. I came back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. Now, I'm, as you probably are well aware, the name Naomi means pleasant. Lovely. And so the ladies, well, can this be Naomi? And she says, don't call me pleasant. I apparently don't have any intention of being pleasant. Call me Mara or bitter. Call me bitter because that's what I am. Now, I don't know if this has been your experience or not, but my experience when I've counseled bitter people, if I try to gently say to them, do you think that maybe the suffering you've experienced has created some bitterness in your life? Do you know what the response is that I always hear? I'm not bitter. I'm not bitter. I have never, ever had anybody tell me I'm a bitter person. So I just have to wonder how bitter you have to be before you'll say, call me bitter. I am bitter, because my experience has been every time I've tried to gently ask, do you think this could have made you bitter? I'm not bitter. I'm thinking, you got to be really bitter. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Now, Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor. So here we see Ruth's character coming out again. She's taking the initiative. She's searching out a way to be helpful and provide for their family. Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they called back. Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, "Whose young woman is that?" The foreman replied, "She's the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters.' She went into the field and has worked steadily from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter." So now what else have we just learned about Ruth?
Hard worker.
Hard worker. So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting and follow along after the girls. I've told the men not to touch you, and whenever you're thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled." At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" You think about, you know, here she is. She's come back with her mother-in-law, and her mother-in-law says, "I came back empty." She's had to feel very, very lonely. Very, very lonely. And now someone has shown kindness to her, and you just see how much that meant to her. She bows to the ground, and she says, "Why have I found so much favor in your eyes?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you didn't know before. May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." So we learn that not only is she kind, but she has, I mean, her reputation has spread already. He's heard about her and her kindness. "May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she says. "You have given me comfort. You've given me comfort and spoken kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servant girls." At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here, have some bread and dip it in the wine." When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. Now, are you just fascinated about this detail that God would inspire the writer to put in this book? Ruth did not clean her plate. Okay? For all eternity, God has inspired that this detail should be kept track of in the book of Ruth. She did not clean her plate at lunch. Interesting, huh? We're going to see that God notices everything and does not forget the smallest details. We're going to come back to this detail in just a minute. As she got to glean, Boaz gave some orders to his men. "Even if she gathers among the sheaves, don't embarrass her. Rather, pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. And then what would you want to do? You've been out there all day going like this in the sun. Okay, most of us couldn't even stand to sit in the sun for lunch yesterday, right? She's been out there all day in the sun going like this. Okay, so what do you want to do now? I think you want to go and get in the sauna, right? Or the sauna, the hot tub. Okay, and what does she do? She says, then she, I lost my plates in my notes, but anyway, she threshed it, and it amounted to about an ephah. She carried it back into town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she'd gathered. Listen to this detail coming back up now. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. God kept track for all ages of that detail of kindness. Okay, so when we're talking about living with a bitter person, and you think that it doesn't matter, God is keeping track. God is keeping track of every kind word, every kind deed. There is no detail too small that he's not noticing. He notices the smallest details about what you are doing and showing kindness. Her mother-in-law asked her, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she'd been working. "The name of the man that I worked with today is Boaz," she said. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. She added, that man is a close relative. He's one of our kinsmen redeemers. Then Ruth the Moabite said, he even said to me, stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, it will be good for you, my daughter, to go with his girls, because in someone else's field, you might be harmed. So Ruth stayed close to the servant girls of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvest were finished. And she lived with her mother-in-law, and apparently she's providing for both of them. We can probably presume that her mother-in-law is elderly at this point. She's raised two sons, and so she's probably an elderly woman, and Ruth is providing for both of them. One day, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for? Is not Boaz, whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours? Tonight, he'll be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying, then go over and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. I will do whatever you say, Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. Again, I just think this is interesting, okay? How many of us are willing to say to a bitter person, I'll do whatever you say. I'll do whatever you say. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. Who are you? He asked. I'm your servant, Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you're a kinsman redeemer. The Lord bless you, my daughter, he replied. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You've not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. The whole city knows Ruth, a woman of noble character. She hasn't even lived there that long, and she has a reputation, a woman of noble character. Boaz continues, although it is true that I am near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I. Stay here for the night. In the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. But if he's not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I'll do it. Lie here until morning. So she lay at his feet until morning, but he got up before anyone could be recognized, and he said, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. He also said, bring me the shawl you're wearing and hold it out. When she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then he went back to town. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, how'd it go, my daughter? Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her and added, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. Then Naomi said, wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled. Well, we know what happens next, right? He goes, the kinsman redeemer who has the higher claim is not interested in having Ruth. And so Boaz says, I want her for my wife. They marry. And then as we get to the end of chapter 4, so Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. Then he went to her and the Lord enabled her to conceive and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. And we know that line is going to become very famous, right? He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age for your daughter-in-law. This is what the women are saying to you. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, that's certainly been proved true, who loves you and is better than 7 sons, has given birth. Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and cared for him. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. All right, well, this is a session on how to live with a bitter person. What evidence do we have that Ruth is living with a bitter person? Do we have enough evidence to say that this can be a good case study for how to live with a bitter person? What's our evidence? Her name. That's the most compelling piece, right? Call me bitter. Okay, I think that's pretty compelling. Very compelling. Is there any supporting evidence? Yeah, she doesn't acknowledge, I've come back empty, right? I've come back empty. And we hear at the end of the book, this daughter-in-law is better than seven sons. Clearly the town doesn't agree that she's come back empty. Okay.
She was blind to God's work.
Yes, she was blind to God's provision for her, his work in this. She doesn't see it. What else? Yes, yes. I just told you how it infuriated me what she said to them. What else?
Because she was so self-preoccupied. She didn't think of Ruth as somebody that could be an assistant to her.
Yeah.
She just persuaded her to go back to her gods.
Yeah, yeah. Anything else?
I think she let her loss that she suffered with her husband, probably that she did love her sons, anger turned to bitterness
yeah.
her loss.
Yes. And really, I mean, in this story, I mean, Naomi's loss is great. I mean, think about it. If you lost your spouse and your children, I mean, your grief would be overpowering. So it's not like there wasn't genuine suffering here. There was. I mean, if we lost our spouse and our children, that's genuine suffering. So it's not that she wasn't suffering. It's not that she didn't have reason to be grieving, to be hurting badly. But it just shows us how, unless we see the Lord in it, it's going to turn and go in a really, really bad direction. And I think that we see that probably had happened for Naomi. Now, imagine that you are Ruth and that your mother-in-law is Naomi. And just tell me how you might be tempted to respond. Okay, I want to know how you'd be tempted to respond. I don't want to know the glorifying God, goody-two-shoes answer. I want to know how you might be tempted to respond, who looks at you and says, I came back empty. How might you be tempted to respond?
Defend yourself.
Defend yourself.
And how about when I, and what about?
Yes, yes. I think I would certainly be tempted to do that, to defend myself. Yes.
I would just turn around and go, okay, bye.
Yeah. And you know what? Neither daughter-in-law did that. Orpha did go back, but Orpha didn't go back with a snotty attitude, did she? They both wept. They both said, we want to go on with you. Neither one of them did that. Do you think you might be tempted to respond with sarcasm to her? Sarcasm? Are you going to wait around for me to have more sons? Well, what makes you think I'd want another son of yours anyway? I'll just tell you, it didn't take me that long to come up with that response either. So says something about my heart. It's not just what comes out automatically. With self-pity, right? I mean, they're grieving too. They're grieving too. Naomi has lost her husband. She has lost her brother-in-law. She has lost her father-in-law. Would any of you, I think, be tempted to maybe complain to the women that you're out in the field with about your mother-in-law? Yes. Apparently she wasn't doing that because the whole town knows that she's a woman of noble character. I don't think you get that label if you're complaining to everyone around you. Or, as you've mentioned, just washing your hands of Naomi. Okay, well, obviously there's a lot of temptation, a lot of pressure to respond in a sinful way. We don't see Ruth doing that. We don't see Ruth doing that. So I think one of the lessons that we need to take away in how to live with a bitter person from Ruth's example is don't respond by sinning yourself. Don't respond by sinning yourself. The pressures will be great. The pressures will be great to do exactly that. To respond to that brother who comments about our hair color by saying, well, at least I still have hair. Okay. To respond to that disrespectful niece by giving her the cold shoulder. To that mother-in-law who doesn't think that we're good enough for her child, putting pressure on our spouse not to visit, not to spend the holidays with that mother-in-law, right? And although we weren't necessarily the initiator in those situations, we can pick up the ball and run with it pretty well. So, one of the things that we're going to keep in mind is don't respond by sinning yourself. don't respond by sinning yourself. Well, what's going to keep us from that? Well, we're going to have to see God in this. I mean, obviously, there's no way not to if we don't see God in this. And although Ruth never verbally tells us what helps her in this situation, I would imagine that if we could interview her, that we might hear her make a response something like this. So we've got a reporter who comes up to Ruth and says, "Ruth, I'm from the Bethlehem Nightly News, and we're here to do a feature on how to live with a bitter person. We've heard that you live with Mara. How do you do it?" Here's how I think we might hear Ruth respond. Well, you know, as you know, I'm originally from Moab, and it was there that I met my husband to be, Mahlon. And Mahlon introduced me to his God, the one true God. I came to trust in his God and learn more and more about him. Three things I've learned about God that have been a tremendous help to me. One, God is sovereign. He's the one in control. Two, God uses his control to work everything together for good for his children. And three, the good that God has in mind is to make me like the coming Messiah. And knowing that God is up to something good has been a tremendous benefit to me. It changes my perspective to what's really important, being like the Messiah. Now, Ruth doesn't tell us that, but I think we have those same principles spelled out for us explicitly in the New Testament, don't we? Romans 8, 28 and 29, we know that God is working all things together for good. So although Ruth doesn't say it, I think we see as an example in the Old Testament of what we're going to be communicated specifically in the New Testament. Now, consider James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4 with me, please. That passage says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds." Why? Because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance. And perseverance must finish its work so you can be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Okay, now, how many of you have seen Let's Make a Deal? This probably dates me. I'm sure it dates me, okay, unless you've seen it on whatever you can probably watch it on the internet now. I don't know. I don't remember a whole lot about it, okay, but I remember it was hosted by Monty Hall, and that people dressed up weird, and that at the end, the lucky contestant got to choose their grand prize from behind door number one, door number two, or door number three. And if you watch the show for any time at all, if you were a savvy contestant, you knew door number two. Door number two was always the best door, so you would, of course, always choose door number two. So let's say that you are the lucky contestant on Let's Make a Deal, and you get to choose door number one, door number two, door number three, okay? And because you are savvy in the way of this game, what door are you going to choose?
Two.
So Monty Hall asks you what door you want. You say, "I want door number two." Carol Merrill goes over, pulls back behind door number two. And what is behind door number two?
A goat.
No, door number two is the best door. What is behind door number two is completeness, maturity, no lack for anything. Aren't you excited? You picked the best door. You knew it. You knew door number two was the best door. Behind it is completeness, maturity, no lack for anything. This is great. You got the best grand prize. Well, now you know the show's not over yet. We've got to see what's behind door number one and door number three that you didn't choose. So Carol Merrill goes over to door number one. She pulls back door number one. And what is behind door number one? Oh, behind door number one is incompleteness and immaturity and lack. And yes, you are making a fool out of yourself. Now you picked the best door. You got the best prize. Yes, 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 yes. You didn't want door number one. You got the best prize. Door number two, completeness, maturity, no lack. Okay, we have 3 minutes left before we cut to the commercial, and we need to see what's behind door number three, don't we? Carol Merrill goes over. She pulls back door number three. And what is behind door number three? You are convinced that there's got to be a donkey. I'm giving you the equivalent of donkey between door number one, okay? Behind door number three, we find ease, pleasure, comfort, but no maturity and no growth. Now, as the camera takes one last shot of your face before it cuts to the commercial, what does it see? Say, yes! Best door number two! Yes! Or is it door number two is always supposed to be the best door. Why did they put the best prize behind door number three? Door number two is supposed to be the best door. And many of the people who we have the opportunity to minister, and even us at sometimes in our life, can look at door number three and say, I just missed out on the best prize. I just missed out on the best prize. When really, you got the best. You got the best. Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds. Because you know the testing of your faith develops perseverance, and perseverance must finish its work so you can be mature and complete, not lacking anything. Second thing that we need to do if we're going to avoid responding sinfully to a bitter person is we're going to have to look in the mirror and examine our own hearts. If we're ever going to be effective in living with a bitter person, we've got to be honest about our own idols, don't we? The places where we've tended to exchange worship and service of the Creator for worship and service of created things. Luke 6, 43 through 45 reminds us we live out of our hearts. No good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. Each tree is recognized by its own fruit. People don't pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars. The good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and the evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. For out of the overflow of his heart, his mouth speaks. So what does that mean? It means that when I make a sharp retort to my brother, when I give my niece the cold shoulder, when I gossip about my mother-in-law, I'm not communicating one single thing about them. I'm telling you what's in my heart. I am revealing my heart to you. And our hearts tend to gush the more that we put pressure on them. So you put me in a bitter person and you turn up the heat, and guess what's going to come gushing out? Whatever happens to be in there. And what gushed out of Ruth's heart? Kindness. Kindness, care for her mother-in-law. And so if we're going to get a handle on this, I think we're going to have to ask God to show us our hearts. Because without that pressure, we can be pretty good at thinking, we're all good. We're all good. And then the pressure comes. And maybe we're not so we're all good anymore. We see the psalmist making this plea in Psalm 26:2, test me, O Lord, and try me, examine my heart and my mind. Well, would you agree with the psalmist? Do that for me, Lord. Do that for me. And when he answers, yes, I'll do that for you, and he puts pressure on your heart so that you can see what's in there, are you going to consider it pure joy? Pure joy that he's letting you see your heart. Psalm 51:10, create in me a pure heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. I think we're going to have to cry out to God with that request, because it's not just going to happen. Lord, please create in me a pure heart, because when I see what's in there, it's not purity that resides in there all on its own. But we want that, don't we? Wouldn't it be sad if all our lives we live with a cesspool sewage pit in our heart, but we never knew it because we never had any pressure there so that we saw it. It was there. We had a cesspool in our hearts, but we never recognized it because we never had enough pressure put on us so that we knew it. The most pressure we got was in the grocery store line when somebody with 12 items in their cart stood in the 10-item line. And we got that much pressure, and so all we did was say, Really? And we don't really think that that was an indication of our hearts, that that was a lack of mercy, that that was a display of self-righteousness. We don't really think there's anything wrong with that. Okay? And so God answers our prayer to search our hearts, and he now puts us in traffic. And somebody cuts us off and almost causes an accident, and the pressure just got a little bit greater, and now our heart comes out a little bit more visibly, doesn't it? You idiot! Right? Okay? More pressure. It was there the whole time. I was always a self-righteous, legalistic, you ought to live by the rules because I only have 6 lines in my cart and you have 12. You shouldn't be in this line. Okay? Now you cut me off. Now my heart comes gushing out. Create in me a pure heart, oh Lord. Create in me a pure heart. We need to be asking God for that. Okay? And then I think the major thing that we see in the book of Ruth about living with a bitter person is be kind. Be kind. How many examples of that could we find in that text? Over and over, couldn't we? Be kind. Be kind. Be kind. Be kind. Be kind. Be kind. I mean, just if you just went through and underlined it, you'd have your whole book underlined. Okay? Every time you see Ruth doing something, she's doing something kind. How do you live with a bitter person? Apparently, you be kind. All right? Be kind. I'm not even going to go through all the examples. You already know it. Be kind. Now, let me give you another thing that I think is we're going to have to work on if we're going to live with a bitter person, and that is, don't wash your hands of them. God didn't wash his hands of us. Ruth stays with her mother-in-law. And I want to be very, very careful to say that I don't believe that Orpah was wrong to go back to her people. She had the liberty to do that. Naomi asked her to do that. She did not go back with a stinking attitude in any way, shape, or form. She wept. I don't think she was wrong to use that liberty, but Ruth stayed. And we're talking about Ruth today. Okay? God didn't wash his hands of us. And it's not wrong to use the liberty that we're given, but I think Ruth would be recognized as having made a very noble choice. Have you read A Tale of Two Cities, Dickens, classic? This was the best of times, the worst of times. That is my favorite Charles Dickens novel. I like it not only because of the suspense and intrigue in it, because of the way it ends. But let me just give you a little synopsis of it, just to refresh your memory on what happens in that book. It takes place in the late 1700s during the period of the French Revolution. So you've got all these rebels getting stirred up in this story, and its central character is a young woman named Lucy Manette. And when we meet Lucy at the beginning of the book, she has been a ward of the bank. I'm not exactly sure how that works, but apparently she's been a ward of the bank because her father is presumed to be dead. Her mother is dead for sure. But all throughout that novel, Lucy is known for her love and for her compassion, for her kindness. Now, as it turns out, her father wasn't really dead. Rather, he had been in prison in France's infamous Bastille for 18 years before the revolution started. He really was a brilliant scientist who had been imprisoned unjustly because he had been witness to a rape and a murder committed by a French aristocrat. And so the aristocrat had him imprisoned because he didn't want anyone to testify against him. But in the course of the story, Lucy finds her father, she brings him back to England with her, and because of her kindness and compassion to him, it looks like he's gone mad from being in prison and his faculties are restored. Now, because of her sweet nature, Lucy has two men who fall in love with her. She makes a good choice and marries Charles Darnay. Charles Darnay is a Frenchman who is living in England for not known to us reasons at this point. But he's a good man. She marries him. That was a good choice. Her other suitor is a man named Sidney Carton. Now, Carton is an alcoholic lawyer, but he too loves Lucy, but he knows he's unworthy of her. He tells Lucy he will embrace any sacrifice for her, even to giving up his own life to keep a life next to her that she loves. He tells her that in his declaration statement of love to her. Now, let me just give you a spoiler alert if you haven't read. I'm about ready to tell you the ending here. In the end, Sidney does just that. Okay, he goes to the guillotine in place of Lucy's husband, who the French revolutionists were going to cut off his head because he was a French aristocrat, and Sidney goes in his place. Okay, now as I said, and he does. He keeps a life beside her that she loves. So exactly what he said he would do, he does it. Now, I like it. I like it because it has all these threads in it that you can't possibly see any connection to, and Dickens weaves them all together in this really interesting way. I like it. I like it. I like it for that reason. But I think another reason that I love it is because you see the beautiful, beautiful story of a man who has wasted his life sacrificing it out of love for someone. And we admire, we respect those who would give up their lives for someone else. What we read in Romans 5:7, this is basically the cliff notes for A Tale of Two Cities. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, but for a good man, someone might possibly dare to die. That is your Tale of Two Cities cliff notes right there. Sidney Carton dies so that Lucy's husband can live. But as much as I love that, what is even more admirable is the non-fictional account of the sacrifice of the one who was worthy for those who weren't. The next verse in Romans, right? Verse 8. Yeah. You can't all hear it. We've got it quoted up here, okay? But God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. We weren't respectable, worthy people to die for. Christ died for us when we were God's enemies. Sidney Carton wasn't dying for his enemy. He was dying to help the woman he loved, to save a good man. God died for his enemies, people who hated him. In Max Lucado's book, The Gift for All People, Lucado writes this: God on a cross, the ultimate act of creative compassion. The creator being sacrificed for the creation. God convincing man once and for all that he would give anything, pay any price to save his children. He could have given up. He could have turned his back. He could have walked away from the wretched mess the world became, but he didn't. God didn't give up. When people from his own hometown tried to push him over a cliff, he didn't give up. When his brothers ridiculed him, he didn't give up. When he was accused of blaspheming God by people who didn't fear God, he didn't give up. When Peter worshiped him at the supper and cursed him at the fire, he didn't give up. When people spat in his face, he didn't spit back. When the bystanders slapped him, he didn't slap them. When a whip ripped his sides, he didn't turn and command the waiting angels to stuff that whip down that soldier's throat. And when human hands fastened the divine hands to the cross with spikes, it wasn't the soldiers who held the hands of Jesus steady. It was God who held them steady. Those same hands that formed the oceans and built the mountains. Those same hands that designed the dawn and crafted each cloud. Those same hands that blueprinted one incredible plan for you and me. God hasn't given up on you. Now let me just balance that. This doesn't mean that you've got to stay in a situation where you bring a tyrant into your home and let that person rule you and destroy your family. It doesn't mean that you become a mouse who is manipulated, afraid to confront, hold in anger. It doesn't mean that you can't go back to your people like Orpha. But nor can you become sarcastic, hostile, self-righteous, irritated, self-pitying, have a you owe me attitude, self-righteous. And it can become easy to shut out those who bring bitterness into our lives. But in Ruth, we find just the opposite. But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. Don't abandon them. Then don't look for comfort and support from the bitter person. Leave that up to God. Don't look for comfort and support from the bitter person. Leave that up to God. While Jesus was on earth, how much support did he get from his earthly family? His brothers thought they were crazy, right? They went to get him. You need to come with us. You are out of your mind. They weren't proud of him. They were embarrassed. They wanted to get rid of him. Jesus didn't depend on his family for support. In fact, listen to how he defines his family. My true brothers and sisters and mother are those who do what God wants. We can't control the way that our family responds to us. When it comes to the behavior of others toward us, our hands are tied. So we've got to move beyond the expectation that we're going to get comfort from them if we can just work a little bit harder, if we can just endure a little bit longer, if we can just do this, then maybe they will. We can't depend on that. Perhaps God will work it out that way, but we can't depend on that. If your brother jabs you about coloring your hair, you can let it go completely gray, and he'll just find something else to pick on, right? If your niece is disrespectful and thinks her parents haven't given her enough, you can give her the world on a plate. That's not going to make her any more respectful necessarily. And you can be the best daughter or son-in-law in the world, and it doesn't necessarily mean that your mother-in-law is going to open her arms and welcome you into the family and include you in the family photos. Okay? Don't look for support from the bitter person. Jesus' support came from his Father. This is my Son with whom I am well pleased. God has proven him a faithful father. You are God's child, and God will give you the blessing he has promised. He will. He will. He may use other people to do that. He brings Boaz into Ruth's life. But don't make that something you're dependent on. And then let's just end by thinking about the results. Do you think that Ruth ever realized while she was going through all this with a bitter mother-in-law that someday she was going to be in the line of Christ? Do you think she thought, well, if I just stick with my mom, with my mother-in-law, if I stick with Naomi, someday I'll be in the line of Christ. If I can just hang on, Jesus will come from my line. She didn't know that. She didn't know that, but God did, and he used Ruth and put her in the line of Christ. Do you think that Ruth had any ideas that centuries later, people in their wedding ceremonies would be quoting her? In wedding ceremony after wedding ceremony after wedding ceremony, people would say, "Where you go, I will go." And how's the rest of it go? Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be centuries later. People are quoting. Do you think she thought, okay, let me work on this one for a while so that it's really worth it, you know? Maybe I can get it into a wedding book, okay? She didn't know that, but God did. And Psalm 112, verse 6 says, "Surely he will never be shaken. A righteous man will be remembered forever." Isn't that Ruth? That's God playing it out right there. A righteous man will be remembered forever. We're still quoting her today. She's in the line of Christ. Well, if that was true of Ruth, let's work hard to make it true of us too by God's grace. We have the same true Messiah. Let's look to him and work to live with bitter people in the way that Ruth set the example for us. Let's pray. Almighty God, we come to you just so thankful for the fact that you remember every detail. Lord, thank you that no act of kindness by your grace on our part is overlooked by you. Thank you that you have promised that a righteous man will be remembered forever, and that our righteousness is from you, Lord, that it's your righteousness. Lord, if it was up to us to come up with our own righteousness, we'd be sunk. We can't live with bitter people. We can get mad at them. We can curse them back. We can become silently angry, but we can't live with bitter people without your grace and your righteousness at work in our hearts. And so, Lord, we call out to you and ask, Lord, will you please do that work in our hearts as you did for Ruth? Will you please help us to eagerly welcome those opportunities and to demonstrate the same kind of kindness, the same kind of love that by your grace you enabled Ruth to love, to do. And then, Lord, will you please get all the glory for it? Will we please magnify you when people look at us and say, wow, look at how they're living with a bitter person. May it reflect on you, and your name will be glorified. Your name will be high and lifted up. That's what we want. We love you. We praise you. We think that you are the worthy one. Amen. All right. Thank you, folks.